Welcome to Anesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anesthetists. My name is Amit Prakash and I'm a consultant at Arden Brooks Hospital in Cambridge, where we run a fellowship program for our portfolio pathway. I'm also vice chair of the Development Innovation Group at the Royal College. And today I'm joined by Dr. Ashwini Kesh Kamath to talk about portfolio pathways. This is part of a special mini-series focusing on portfolio pathways. Ashwini is a senior elected council member at the Royal College. She's chair of the SAS committee and a specialist anesthetist at Dartford and Gresham NHS Trust. Hello, Ashwini.
Hi, Amit. Lovely to have this conversation with you and thank you for inviting me.
No, thank you for coming down. So, Ashwini, the non-clinical domains have always been a part of the evidence for applications. But with the last changes, the GMC stipulates more structured evidence, more organized evidence to be provided. How do you think this will affect the new applicants?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I'm sure most of the applicants have very similar thoughts. So just to clarify, again, as you rightly said, the generic professional capabilities, the domains are aligned to the GMC's good medical practice domains. So when the curriculum changed from the 2010-2017 to the 2021 curriculum, the generic professional capabilities were incorporated into it. So they were required even previously when it was called the equivalence pathway. So now, as you've rightly said, it's more descriptive and structured, and it makes it easier for the applicants to collate their evidence or cross-link to different domains. So say, for example, if an applicant is anesthetizing an ASA 3 case, which requires multidisciplinary team planning, this can be evidenced in both the clinical domains 9 and domain 3. So domain 3 is particularly team working. So as long as the reflections are evidenced. So what I'm trying to say is, this actually can make it more easier for the applicants, but it's important to understand that it's a whole process. So it is a continuous process. There can't be like, oh, we do one domain just as an individual separately and then do the rest. So no, because if you can look at the domains, there is professional behaviors, communication, team working, education and training. All of them kind of blend into our day-to-day anesthetic work. So I hope I've made it slightly clearer to the applicants.
No, thank you. That's really very comprehensive and a very good overview of the changes. And I think you're touching upon one or two things, which I'll come back to a little bit later. In terms of the actual content of these domains we talked about, what would be your tips in terms of gathering evidence for each of these? Just the salient points, really.
Yeah, sure. So I think over the years, what we have seen, the common reasons why applications are unsuccessful is that they lack evidence, say, for example, in logbooks. They don't have logbook summaries or details in the logbooks. Then there is lacking evidence in QI projects or, for example, lack of evidence of attending governance meetings and reflections from it. There's also lack of evidence in teaching and training. Well, applicants do actually submit their teaching and the presentations, but what we have seen over the years is they lack to submit feedback from the cohort of attendees and reflections from learning. So I think the top tips for anyone who is trying to embark on this journey, it's important again for the applicants to know that it is. So say, for example, if you are involved in a QI project, it's important to demonstrate what change, if any, that project has brought about, or has that created any impact, and if that impact is sustainable. And all this can be the evidence in domain 4. Again, just to clarify, so say, for example, when an applicant presents a case or conducts a teaching session, we'd like to see the feedback that was received from the participants that attended the sessions. And then what were the reflections from the feedback that they received? So, for example, if they brought about any change in their future sessions that they did. So this you could possibly evidence in domain 6, which encompasses the education and training. So you need not be an educational supervisor straight away, because that's not possible. But these are the little things that you can do towards collating evidence in those domains. Again, to have another example, so say, for example, when it comes to management or leadership roles. So if an applicant is leading or closely working with a lead in a particular area of clinical practice, that could be their evidence and reflecting on their experience. Or they have been, say, involved in rota management or just managing a complex list. So all this can be part of domain two, which is actually management and professional regulatory requirements. So what I'm trying to say is, all these domains, domain 1 to 7, essentially are what are required by the GMC, even towards an appraisal. So it's only about putting it in a structured format and collating the evidence and have those descriptions and cross-linking your evidence while you submit it for your portfolio pathway.
No, absolutely. I think these non-clinical domains, the way we see them, are part of personal development almost. And so getting feedback and improving upon them, and similarly undertaking audits and then completing audit cycles, is all part of it, because that's how we learn. So no, thank you for that. That's very, very, very useful. Ashwini, you touched upon this a bit earlier, but I just wanted to get a little bit more granularity on, you were mentioning that evidence from one area could be used in other areas. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the best things is, again, it's easier when we talk about examples. So say, for example, you've anesthetized someone with learning disabilities, and there are safeguarding issues around it, and this was an ASA2 case. So this could be your evidence in a clinical domain, as in domain 9, but this could also be cross-linked to safety and safeguarding, which is domain 5. Or, for example, professional behaviors and communication, which could be domain 1. So I think that's to put it in perspective as to how you cross-link it. Again, as I mentioned, if, say, for example, you've done an interesting case and presented in the departmental governance meeting, or, for example, if an applicant has been involved in management of massive obstetric hemorrhage and they have followed the protocols and guidelines locally, presented it in the governance meetings, this could again be demonstrated as evidenced in domain 9, which is the clinical domain, but also cross-link it with safety and management.
The leadership, maybe.
And yes, so depending on whether they were participant in that, as in as a team member. So again, that will depend on their stage of training. So for example, if they are evidencing it as stage 2, then they could be as a clinician, but with the presence of a supervisor in theaters. And then if it is they are providing that evidence as stage 3, then the expectation would be team working and communication or delegating with their reflections in stage 3. So it is, again, a continuous process. So you could still have domains 1 to 6 demonstrated as evidence, very similar scenarios, but your role in those scenarios could be different. And the learning and the reflections you evidence could be different, though the clinical scenarios may be similar.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. That's very insightful. Thank you, Ashwini. Was there anything else that you would want to add on to the non-clinical domains there?
Not necessarily, Amit. I think it's important to know that they have always existed as part of our clinical practice, and that's one of the requirements of the good medical practice set by the GMC. One of the things that I would like to highlight is, now at the college, of course, we have recently published the Maximizing Career Progression document and the autonomous practice. So for those who are, for example, not embarking on the portfolio pathway journey, which are, say, specialty doctors aspiring to be specialists, again, they could use these similar domains as evidence to progress from being a specialty doctor to a specialist. Because essentially, again, the person specifications that describe it are very similar. That is something that I would like to tell all our members. And this is the work that's ongoing, and we've already published that document.
No, that's right. I think we can provide links for that to our audiences. That's really useful.
So thanks, Amit. Actually, I had a question for you. So you've been a program lead for, you know, the portfolio pathway in your trust. So what are the tips that you give? Of course, more than the participants, what do you tell your assessors who run the program?
We have been running this program for a long time, and we have gained a lot of experience over the years. One of the things which we said right from the beginning in terms of the assessor side of things was to treat the trainees or the portfolio pathway applicants just like our deanery trainees. So we make no differentiation in the program about it. And like you said, in the first series also, Derek's mentioned earlier, having them on the LLP is really important. So we make sure all of them are on it. We allocate education supervisors to each of the portfolio pathway applicants. We also advise our assessors to look at the MTRs and the MSFs in detail, because that's a day-to-day review of what the trainee has been doing. We advise quarterly, at least, educational supervisor meetings with the applicants, and also keeping an eye, because that gives you an overview of the logbooks of what they have been doing, what modules they've completed, and so on and so forth. And one of the things which is slightly peculiar in our program is that we undertake what is called an ARCP-like process. So it's a sort of a quality control measure which we have, which means that on a yearly basis, we are able to get feedback from our educational supervisors, the assessors, and then that is looked at by a panel of people to see whether the portfolio pathway applicant has been progressing well or not in the fellowship, as you know, because we have a 3 years fellowship. And I know that you asked me a question specifically in relation to our program, but what I'd like to add is that even if you are not in a program, you need to, or the ideal thing would be to find a supportive consultant within the department who's has the knowledge and is interested in supporting you on the portfolio pathway, and look at the same things which I've mentioned earlier, which is getting onto the LLP, looking after the MTRs, MSFs, and so on and so forth. So I think that overall helps the assessors and also the people who are making applications to go through the pathway successfully.
Yes, thanks, Hamid. I think that's really helpful, because then it means that anyone who is embarking on that journey, whether they are in the portfolio program or not, doing it on their own, they will have to identify an assessor or a consultant who can support them. So thank you so much. And then the top tips for the applicants would be to kind of collate all their evidence on the LLP. So for that, it's important that they have membership of the college so that they can have access to the LLP. Thank you for that.
No, thank you very much, Ashwini. Ashwini, this has been really useful. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll have more information and useful links in the episode description. You can catch the rest of this Portfolio Pathways mini-series and loads more podcasts like this if you subscribe to the Anesthesia On Air. And make sure you review us while you're there. Thank you so much.